Hey, he looks shattered. She doesn't answer. Instead, she says, Well? She doesn't even wait for him to take his jacket off. I told them what you said. Did they believe you? I think so. You think so? She can't keep the edge of hysteria out of her voice. Christ, I don't know. He almost shouts back at her. I don't know what they think. He lowers his voice again. But Becky, there's another problem. What problem? How much worse can it get? He tells her, haltingly. At the resort, I parked in the outdoor parking lot, not the indoor lot. Apparently there's no camera on the outdoor parking lot. So I can't prove I never left. She stares at him for a long moment. But they can't prove I did, either, he says. Maybe it's time we got you a lawyer, she says dully. What does that mean? He says. Don't you believe me? Yes, she says automatically, even though she doesn't know if she believes him or not. He strides into the living room to the bar cart. I need a drink. I went over to see Robert Pierce while you were out, Becky says, her voice a hoarse whisper as she watches him pour himself a stiff whiskey. He whirls around to look at her, the bottle in his hand. What? What the hell did you do that for? He probably murdered his wife. She's staring into space. Now that it's over, she can hardly believe she did it. She must have been out of her mind. I told him that the police think you might have killed Amanda.
Jesus, Becky, that's insane! What did you tell him that for?
She focuses on him now. He seems to have gone a shade paler. I wanted to see what he'd say.
And?
He said it was probably either you or him who killed her. Larry looks horrified.
Becky, he's dangerous. Promise me you won't go near him anymore. Promise!
She nods. She doesn't want to go near Robert Pierce ever again.
Detective Webb drives across the Aylesford Bridge spanning the Hudson and turns north on the highway, Moen beside him in the passenger seat. It's early Monday morning, exactly a week since they found Amanda Pierce's abandoned car, her violently beaten body shoved into the trunk. It's a cold, crisp day, but the sun is out, and it's a pleasant drive. At first, the river is on their right. Soon they turn west, deeper into the Catskills, in the direction of the small town of Spring Hill. The wilderness stretches out all around them as the road curves and winds through the mountains. Eventually, they turn off the highway and take a series of smaller, winding roads. The drive to the Sharps' cabin takes them right past the spot where Amanda's body was found. Paul Sharp must know this stretch of road well. At last they turn down a gravel road and finally stop at a classic wood cabin that looks weathered, nestled in among the trees. Webb sees a car parked in front. Paul Sharp is here ahead of them. No surprise there. They climb out of the car. The air is fresher here, and smells of earth, wet leaves, and pine needles. Breezes rustle through the remaining leaves on the trees overhead. They can see a small lake farther down, a dock jutting out into the water. The door to the cabin opens, and Paul Sharp steps out, looking wary. His wife, Olivia, is right behind him. Olivia decided to come along because she couldn't stand the thought of staying home and worrying about what was going on out here. Olivia had tossed in bed the night before, unable to sleep, thinking about the cabin. It wasn't the same now that Raleigh was 16. He still enjoyed the cabin, loved the lake, but he didn't look forward to it with gleeful excitement the way he had when he was little. By Sunday afternoon, he was usually missing his friends and his Wi-Fi. So they tended to go back earlier than when he was a little boy, when she and Paul practically had to drag him into the car to go home. She hadn't noticed anything different about the cabin 2 weekends ago when they'd come up to start closing it up for the winter. It had been Columbus Day weekend, the weekend after Amanda had disappeared, the weekend before they'd had the Newells over for dinner, and Olivia had found out that Raleigh was breaking into houses. Everything had been just as it was the last time they were at the cabin. She doesn't understand what the hell the detectives want. She's always loved their little cabin in the woods. It's not fancy, just one large room that's part kitchen, part living room, with a view down to the lake along the back, and 2 bedrooms and a small bathroom on the other side of the living area. The floor is linoleum, the walls are wood-paneled, the furniture is mismatched but comfortable, and the appliances are outdated, but that's all part of its charm. She hopes that this doesn't spoil it for them. They didn't tell Raleigh what was happening today. He'd gone to school early for basketball practice, leaving before they did. It will be over soon enough, and he will never have to know that the police were even here. She steps out of the cabin behind her husband and is surprised to see that it's just Webb and Moen. She was expecting an entire team. It makes her relax a little bit. "Good morning," she says. She knows that Paul will be brusque with them. That's the way he is. She must try to smooth things over. "Can I offer you some coffee?"
"That would be great, thank you," Webb says, smiling his quick smile.
"Yes, that would be lovely," Moen says warmly. "Beautiful spot you've got here." They all go inside, and Olivia turns away and busies herself with the old, serviceable coffee maker. She takes down 4 blue enamel cups. These old chipped cups comfort her, remind her of relaxed, happier times. Morning coffee on the deck, with the mist rising off the water. Hot cocoa for Raleigh when he was little, wrapped in a red and black plaid blanket against the chill. She glances over her shoulder and sees the detectives each pulling on blue latex gloves. And just like that, all her happy feelings abruptly disappear.
Chapter 29.
She brings the coffee over to the detectives. They accept it gratefully. Olivia finds the sight of those latex gloves holding her cups unsettling. The detectives begin to go about their work. Olivia and Paul sit silently at the kitchen table, trying to pretend that they don't mind, that they're not watching the two cops' every move. When the detectives leave the main room of the cabin and go into the bedrooms, Paul gets up and follows, taking his coffee with him. Olivia gets up too. The detectives open drawers, look under mattresses. They put everything back the way they found it. She has no idea what they expect to find. They return to the kitchen and go through it methodically, silently. The longer it goes on, the more anxious Olivia becomes. She watches as Webb studies the navy curtains carefully. Silently, he waves Moen over. Together, they look at the curtains, both sides, with the aid of a flashlight. Webb's face seems to turn grim. Finally, Webb turns to Olivia's husband and says, "Do you have any tools?"
"Tools?" Paul repeats.
Olivia wonders if they want to take something apart. She's not going to allow that, and she's sure Paul won't either. If they want to start tearing up the floorboards, they will have to get a damn warrant. Paul must be thinking along the same lines she is, because he says, "What for?"
"Where do you keep them?"
Webb asks, avoiding the question. Without answering, Paul leads them outside to a small shed not far from the cabin. It's full of firewood, plastic lawn chairs, a lawn mower, and other accumulated junk. Olivia peers around Paul as he opens the door to the shed and points. Webb pulls out his flashlight and flicks it on, playing the light over the interior of the shed. There's a hatchet leaning up against the wall. The light lands on a battered red metal toolbox. The detective steps inside and squats down and opens it. He uses an index finger to search inside the toolbox, his blue gloves stark and clean against the dusty interior. Olivia wonders what the hell he's looking for. She can see the tension in Paul's shoulders.
"Do you have a hammer?" Webb asks.
"Yes," Paul says. "It should be there." He bends down to look inside the toolbox.
"It doesn't appear to be here now," Webb says, and turns his attention to Paul. "When was the last time you saw it?"
"I have no idea," Paul says. "I don't remember."
The two men stare at each other for a long moment.
Olivia feels her stomach drop. She's been telling herself that the detectives are on a fool's errand, that they won't find anything, and then they'll leave them alone. But there it is again, the doubt niggling at the back of her mind. Do the detectives know something that she doesn't?
Webb looks up at Moen and says, "I think we need to get the crime team out here."
"You're going to need a warrant for that," Paul says angrily. Olivia stares at her husband, her heart pounding.
"I can do that," Webb says, "with a phone call. And I can have a forensic unit out here within a couple of hours."
Webb watches Paul Sharp, standing by the shed in the sunlight filtering through the trees, his hands down by his sides.
"What's going on?" his wife blurts out suddenly, her face ashen. "Paul had nothing to do with Amanda Pierce. Why aren't you after her husband? He's probably the one who killed her." Olivia, you're not helping, Sharp says. They've obviously made up their minds. Let them search. There's nothing to find.
While they wait for the crime scene team to arrive, Webb and Moen explore the area outside the cabin, while the Sharps stand by mutely and watch. Finally, they all turn as a couple of police cars and a white crime scene van pull up to the cabin. Webb knows that if this cabin is a crime scene, it has already been compromised, but they must search it regardless. Webb points out the suspicious stains on the kitchen curtains, the stains that look like blood, to the technicians. If it is blood, they will be able to get DNA from the stains. Webb and Moen watch silently while the technicians close all the blinds and curtains to darken the room. A tech begins to spray luminol in the kitchen. The kitchen floor lights up near the back windows and shows a path from there to the sink on the opposite side of the room. The tech gives the detectives a meaningful glance.
What's that? Paul asks.
The lit-up areas show the presence of blood, Webb says, even when it has been cleaned up and is invisible to the eye. He looks at the couple standing at the edge of the kitchen. Webb doesn't know who looks worse. Olivia Sharp looks like she's about to faint. Paul Sharp is standing completely still, staring at the floor, his face slack with incomprehension and shock. The tech then sprays the area around the sink, and it lights up too. But as they proceed, the biggest area where the blood has been scrubbed clean, at least to the human eye, is at the back of the kitchen on the floor in front of the windows that face the lake. There is evidence of wiped-up blood spatter on the walls and even the ceiling as well. The luminescence fades after a few moments, but they have all seen it. With the help of the chemical, it has become obvious that Amanda Pierce, or somebody, was attacked in the kitchen near the back windows, and that something, probably a weapon, was carried from where the attack occurred to the kitchen sink. The evidence of blood spatter arcing on the nearby walls and ceiling indicates that she was struck violently and repeatedly with something hard, the missing hammer. Webb steps forward and says to Paul Sharp, "You are under arrest for the murder of Amanda Pierce. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to speak to an attorney and to have an attorney present during any questioning. If you cannot afford a lawyer, one will be provided for you at government expense. Do you understand these rights?"
Olivia Sharp slides to the floor before anyone can catch her. Chapter 30. Olivia is so disoriented that she can barely function. She hardly remembers the drive back to the city. Her husband went in the police car, handcuffed, on his way to the police station. She followed in the back of the detective's car, her mind numb, Webb driving, while Moen drove the Sharps' car back to the station, and the forensic team was left behind to finish processing the scene. Now she's sitting at the station, waiting for someone to come out and tell her what's happening and what will happen next. She couldn't bring herself to meet Paul's eyes when he was arrested. She keeps seeing the lit-up areas where the blood had been in their cabin. She has to fight down the bile that's rising in her throat. That stain had been there, but invisible, since Amanda was murdered. Olivia had stood on it a couple of weekends ago, the last time they were at the cabin, looking out at the water in the morning, holding her coffee, thinking that everything was right with the world. The last normal weekend. The weekend before she found out Raleigh had been breaking into places. The weekend before Amanda's body had been found. But nothing had been right at all. These things had already happened, and she had simply been unaware of them. It seems like a lifetime ago. She's appalled at her own monumental ignorance. She'd had no idea that a murder had taken place where she stood. She can't get it out of her mind, can't stop seeing it. The lit-up pattern on the floor, the evidence of blood spatter on the wall, and all the way up to the ceiling. She thinks about their missing hammer, heavy and familiar, its old wooden handle with layers of white paint on it. Did Amanda know she was going to die? She must have screamed. Out there, no one would have heard her. Olivia imagines the hammer coming down on the woman whose face she knows only casually and from that one photograph they keep showing online. When Olivia closes her eyes, she sees the trail leading from where she was murdered to the kitchen sink. Her sink, where she washed the dishes 2 weekends ago, while Paul stood beside her and dried, making idle chatter. knowing all the while what had happened there the week before, what he'd done, thinking he'd cleaned it all up. She remembers Paul's face, pale as chalk, as they took him away, and he said to her,
"I didn't do this, Olivia. You must believe me."
She wants to, but how can she believe him? What will she tell Raleigh? Suddenly she needs a toilet, but there's no time. She throws up all over her own lap, the chair, the floor.
Detective Webb pauses outside the door of the interview room. Moen is already in there with Paul Sharp. Webb is tired and takes a moment to prepare himself mentally. Then he opens the door. Sharp is slumped in the chair, his cuffed hands on the table in front of him. He looks terrible. His eyes are watery, as if he's trying not to cry. What had he expected, Webb thinks. Why do they always think they can get away with it? He remembers what Sharp was like at the beginning. He denied knowing Amanda Pierce. Then he admitted to being in the car with her, but only after they told him that he'd been seen. The story about Larry Harris? It had had the ring of truth because it was true. They'd subsequently confirmed that Larry had been seeing Amanda. But why had he been warning her off Larry, as he claimed? Maybe it wasn't because he was trying to protect a friend. Maybe he was jealous. Maybe he was involved with Amanda himself. He'd argued with her that night, a little more than a week before she went missing. What happened that Friday night? They couldn't confirm he'd been at his aunt's. He could have been at the cabin. He could have met Amanda there, killed her with the missing hammer, thrown the murder weapon in the lake. He could have driven her car to that spot at the neighboring lake and sunk it and walked back to his own car at the cabin. The walk would have taken a little over an hour. He could have done it. They don't know what time he got home that night. Webb sits down across from Sharp and looks at him for a moment. "You're in a lot of trouble," he says. Sharp raises his eyes to him and gives him a look of pure fear. "I want a lawyer," Sharp says. "I'm not talking to you without a lawyer present." "Fine," Webb says, standing up again. He hadn't expected anything else. Glenda hears the ping, glances down, and sees the text on her cell phone. "I'm at the police station. Please come." It's from Olivia. What is Olivia doing at the police station? Glenda doesn't tell Adam, just home from school, where she's going, just that she's going to see Olivia. She parks the car and rushes up the steps into the police station. She asks for Olivia and is directed to a small waiting area. The smell of vomit assails her, and she sees immediately that Olivia has been sick, but someone has tried to clean her up.
"Olivia, Christ, what's the matter? What's happened?"
Olivia starts to tell her, crying, and Glenda gets the gist of it, feels her body growing colder and colder as she pieces things together from Olivia's sobbing account. The worst possible news. She's stunned. Paul, arrested for the murder of Amanda Pierce, evidence of blood found in the cabin. Olivia has her face buried in Glenda's shoulder. Glenda is grateful that, for the moment at least, Olivia can't see her horrified expression. Glenda must pull herself together. Olivia needs her. Finally, she pushes Olivia away gently so that she can look at her. "Olivia," she says, "I'm going to help you get through this." Olivia looks back at her as if she is the only thing keeping her together. "Okay?" Olivia nods dumbly. "You need to get Paul a lawyer, the best one we can find." Olivia nods again, almost distractedly, and whispers,
"What am I going to tell Raleigh?"
"I don't know," Glenda thinks. They can't hide it from him. She says, "We'll figure it out. We'll tell him together. Come on, let's get you home."
"Wait,"
Olivia says.
"What?"
Olivia looks at her desperately and lowers her voice to a whisper.
"Do I tell Raleigh that he didn't do it?"
Glenda doesn't know how to answer. Finally, she says, "What did Paul say?" Olivia averts her eyes.
"He said he didn't do it."
"Then that's what you tell Raleigh," Glenda says. She bundles Olivia into her car and drives her home. Paul's car can stay there overnight. She'll come back for it in the morning. The sight of the familiar house as they pull up makes Glenda's heart sink. She's dreading what's to come. But she will stick by Olivia, no matter what, no matter how ugly it gets. That's what friends are for.
Raleigh must wonder where she's been all day, Olivia thinks, dully.
She'd texted him somehow from the station, saying she'd be home soon. Olivia doesn't know where to find the courage to tell him. How do you tell your son that his father has been arrested for murder? She wants to believe it's all a terrible mistake. The police make mistakes all the time. But then she remembers the bloodstains. She can't forget them. When she opens the door, she hears Raleigh's steps hurrying down the stairs to greet her. His face falls when he sees her and Glenda. He can tell something's wrong. "Mom, where have you been?" he asks. Olivia wants to protect him, but she can't protect him from this. Everyone will know. She can't keep it from him. Her son's life is going to be ripped apart in the next few minutes. You try so hard to do everything right, but then... Suddenly she is so tired that she can hardly stand. "Let's sit down," Glenda says, and leads Olivia into her own living room, guiding her by the elbow until she slumps down on the sofa. "What's wrong?" Raleigh demands in a hollow voice. "Where's Dad?"
"Your father is at the police station," Olivia says finally, trying to keep her face from crumbling.
He looks back at her with blank incomprehension, but then he seems to get it. She can see it in his face, the dawning dread.
"He's been arrested," she says.
"What?" Raleigh asks. "For what?"
"For the murder of Amanda Pierce," Olivia says, her voice breaking.
There's a stunned silence. "That's crazy," Raleigh protests after a moment. "Why? Why did they arrest him?"
This is so hard. She has to tell him. "They searched our cabin today, and they found evidence."
"What evidence?" Raleigh demands, his face contorted with emotion. "Dad didn't kill her. He didn't really know her, right? He just saw something. He was covering for somebody, that's all. That's what he said."
It hurts her to look at her son, struggling with this. It feels so brutal what she must tell him now. "They found some bloodstains in the cabin. They're going to do some tests and see if it's Amanda Pierce's blood."
Her voice is a rough whisper. "How can they arrest him if they don't even know it was her blood?" Raleigh says desperately. "They must have something else."
"Our hammer is missing."
There's another long silence. Finally, Olivia says,
"Your father has told them he didn't do it."
"Of course he didn't do it." There are tears in Raleigh's eyes. She says, her body limp,
"The police want all of us, Keith and Adam, to give our fingerprints tomorrow, because we've all been at the cabin. They want to see if there are any other prints there that they can't account for."
Olivia lies in bed, rigid, eyes wide open and staring sightlessly at the ceiling, thinking of her husband in a cell. Glenda is in the next room, staying over for support. She'd made Olivia have a bath, thrown her soiled and smelly clothes in the washing machine, and made everyone soup and toast that mostly went uneaten. Olivia glances at the digital clock on her bedside table. It's 3:31 a.m. Her mind has been going around in circles, an endless loop of horror and disbelief. Paul calling from work that day, saying he was going to see his aunt. Had he been lying? Her thinking nothing of it, watching a movie on her own that night, choosing something she knew he wasn't interested in seeing. Him creeping in late after she was already asleep. She has no idea what time he came home. This is what trust does. You don't notice these things. You don't question them because you think you have no reason to. Now she wishes she'd been less trusting. She wishes she'd paid attention. What was he wearing when he came home? She has no idea because she was asleep. Was he still in his office clothes? She certainly didn't notice anything like bloodstains on his clothes the next day. She would have noticed that and remembered, no matter how trusting she'd been. If he killed Amanda, he must have gotten rid of his clothes somehow. She gets up, turns on the bedside table lamp, and starts searching through his closet, clawing through his chest of drawers. All his suits seem to be accounted for, but Paul has a lot of clothes, especially old jeans and t-shirts. She can't think of anything that isn't there. He keeps clothes at the cabin, too. Something might be missing, and she wouldn't necessarily know. He must have been seeing Amanda. She remembers watching all the men fawning over her at the party in the park. Some of the neighbors had got a permit to barbecue. They'd all chipped in $20 per family for hot dogs and hamburgers and soda and beer, and most of them had brought a salad or some kind of dish. There was a bouncy castle for the younger kids and some balloons.
but most of the teenagers didn't bother showing up. Olivia was tidying up the ketchup and mustard dispensers, occasionally throwing a glance at the semicircle of people talking and laughing in the white plastic chairs that had been rounded up for the occasion. She watched the new woman, Amanda something, who had recently moved in on their street. She was absolutely gorgeous and completely aware of it. Why was she bothering to flirt with their much older husbands? She had a hot-looking husband sitting right beside her. None of the women liked her. Glenda had come up and stood beside Olivia, following her gaze, watching in apparent disbelief as Amanda let her hand, with her long red nails, rest on Keith's forearm. "Who the hell does she think she is?" Glenda said. Then Becky came up on the other side of Olivia, and the three of them stood watching their husbands, clearly in thrall to this new woman. They should all have been more on their guard, Olivia thinks, coming back to the present. Perhaps Becky's instincts were right after all, and Paul and Amanda had become lovers. Did they meet at the cabin that night? Did Paul beat her to death with their hammer, and then stuff her body in her trunk and sink her car, and then scrub everything clean and come home and behave as if nothing had happened? What other explanation can there be? Olivia gets out of bed and pads down the hall quietly, past the spare room, careful not to wake Glenda, who she can hear snoring lightly through the partly open door. She reaches her son's room and quietly pushes his door ajar. She watches him sleep, completely unaware of her. For the moment, at least, he's peaceful. She moves closer and looks down at him. His young face is angular and constantly changing these days. He's growing some whiskers. It's a face she adores. She would do anything to protect him. She wants to sit down on his bed beside him and stroke his hair the way she used to when he was little. But Raleigh doesn't want his mother stroking his hair anymore, not like when he was very young. He doesn't want her hugs and kisses anymore. He's almost grown up. And he keeps things from her. He never did that when he was little. He told her everything. But now he has secrets. Raleigh is keeping things from her. Like his father. They both have secrets. She's the only one in the house who has nothing to hide.
Chapter 31. Becky Harris stands staring down at the morning newspaper in her hands. The headline screams in large print, "Arrest in Amanda Pierce Murder." Her first thought is, "They've arrested Robert." She feels an intense relief. And then, as she reads, oh no, she can't believe it. She thinks of Olivia. She can imagine what she's going through because Becky's been imagining herself going through the very same thing. She takes the paper through to the kitchen. She's alone in the house. Larry has already gone to work. The evidence, as much as the article reveals, sounds damning. Blood found in the Sharps' cabin, now thought to be the scene of the murder. A missing hammer, the possible murder weapon, yet to be recovered. And the car with her body in it found not far from there on a route familiar to Paul Sharp. Stunned and incredulous, Becky thinks back to that time she saw Paul with Amanda in her car. Was she right? Were they lovers after all? Was he jealous of the affair she was having with Larry? Maybe that's why he told her to break it off with Larry, rather than any altruistic concern about Larry getting into trouble at work. She hadn't thought Paul was capable of hurting anyone. But she hadn't thought Larry was, either. She imagines how it must have been. They argued at his cabin, and he struck her. Maybe the hammer was lying close by, and he acted impulsively. He was probably horrified at what he'd done, probably regretted it immediately. But then, he covered it up. He put her body in the trunk and sank it. What must life have been like for him since it happened, especially since the body was found? It must have been a living hell. There will be a trial. Larry will have to testify about his affair with Amanda, his sordid meetings with her in that awful hotel. The thought of all of this out in the open sickens her. How horrible it will be for her and the kids. But it will be far worse for Olivia and Raleigh. She rereads the newspaper article. Things look very bad for Paul. But at least she knows now that her own husband, despite all his failings, didn't kill Amanda Pierce. She really hadn't been sure. Carmen Torres is shocked by what she reads in the newspaper Tuesday morning. They've arrested Paul Sharp for the murder of Amanda Pierce. She thinks of the poor woman she spoke to at the door, Paul Sharp's wife, and how ill she looked that day. Maybe she knew. Maybe it wasn't only her son she'd been worried about. Paul Sharp has lawyered up, but Webb still hopes to get somewhere with him when they question him this morning, with his lawyer by his side. His lawyer hadn't been available the night before, but now that Paul Sharp has had a night in a cell to think about his situation, maybe he will be more cooperative. As he enters the room, he sees Sharp sitting, no longer cuffed, beside his attorney. He looks as if he hasn't slept at all. He has to be scared shitless. Good. Maybe he's ready to talk. Sitting next to Sharp is Emilio Gallo, a well-known criminal lawyer from a respected firm. Webb has dealt with him before. He's good. Expensive. Gallo will stop at nothing to help a client, as long as it's legal. His dark, nicely tailored suit, pressed shirt, and smart silk tie contrast starkly with the rumpled jeans and wrinkled shirt of his client. Sharp is tired and scruffy, and Webb can smell the sweat and fear coming off him. Gallo is well-rested and well-groomed, smelling faintly of expensive aftershave. Webb and Moen sit down. The tape is turned on. "Please state your name for the tape," Webb directs. "Paul Sharp," he says, his voice shaky. Also present are Emilio Gallo, attorney for Paul Sharp, Detective Webb, and Detective Moen of Aylesford Police. Webb begins. He doesn't mince words. "Your client is going to be facing a murder charge," he says, looking directly at Gallo. "Good luck with that," Gallo says mildly. "My client didn't do it." Webb turns his gaze on Paul Sharp. He waits until Sharp finally looks up at him. "I want to hear it from him." Sharp says, "I didn't do it." "The evidence against you is pretty compelling," Webb says. "It's all circumstantial," the attorney counters. "A missing hammer? Blood on the floor? You haven't even confirmed that it's the dead woman's blood." "When we do, perhaps you'll see things differently," Webb says. "I don't think so," Gallo replies. "Anyone could have been in that cabin. Anyone could have found the hammer in the shed and used it. You have nothing against my client except that he wasn't home that night, and he has a perfectly reasonable explanation for where he was." "That he can't prove," Webb says. "He was seen arguing with the victim before she disappeared." "And he has a perfectly good explanation for that, too," the attorney says smoothly. "Maybe we don't believe him." "It doesn't matter what you believe," Gallo says. "What matters is what will hold up in court." Now the attorney leans a little closer and says, "I think we both know you'll have a tough time getting a conviction. There are other rather obvious suspects in this case. The husband, who may have known about his wife's infidelity, and her lover. I understand there was a lover. My client denies having any kind of relationship with the victim. Lots of reasonable doubt, if you ask me. You'll never get this to stick." Webb sits back in his chair, lifts his chin at Paul Sharp, and says, "She was murdered in his cabin. And anyone could have killed her there." The attorney stands up, indicating that the interview is over. "You either have to charge my client or let him go." Webb turns the tape off. "We can hold him a bit longer," Webb says. After Sharp has been taken back to his cell and his attorney has left, Moen says to Webb, "With Gallo representing him, he's never going to break down and confess." "So we have to build a case," Webb says. "We have work to do." Olivia looks back at her husband. He's sitting across from her in a small room at the police station. There is a guard nearby. She stares at him in his messy, slept-in clothes. He is barely recognizable as her husband. Is he? Or is he someone else altogether? She doesn't trust her own judgment, her own senses anymore. "Gallo thinks he might be able to get me out of here," Paul says. She can't speak. "Olivia, say something," Paul demands. He is distraught. His eyes are bloodshot, and he already smells of the cells of fear and desperation. She can't stop staring at him. He looks so different. He already looks more like a prisoner than he looks like her husband of a week ago, going off to work in an ironed shirt, a good suit.
The world has gone all tilted, and she can't find her balance.
What did he say? She asks finally.
He said that they'll have trouble getting a conviction.
He looks both desperate and hopeful at the same time, a drowning man reaching for a life raft. Does she extend her arm and help him, or does she push him away?
Why did he say that? She asks. She feels and sounds like an automaton.
Surely he's wrong, she's thinking. Why would he tell his client such an obvious lie?
Somewhere in the back of her mind, she's also thinking that this is going to cost them a fortune. Probably everything they have.
If he did it, maybe it would be better for everyone if he just admitted it and pleaded guilty, she thinks.
We know I didn't kill her, Paul says, which means somebody else must have.
She looks at him, wanting to believe him. She would rather he be wrongly accused, to know in her heart that he is innocent and stand by him and fight tooth and nail to get this sorted out.
But she's not sure. She needs convincing. She wants to be convinced. She wants to believe him.
What did Gallo say, exactly? She asks, daring to hope he has some good news.
He said there are other, better suspects. Her husband, Larry, who probably was having an affair with her. They need to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, and there's plenty of room for reasonable doubt.
She was hoping for something more conclusive, something that would exonerate her husband, clear him once and for all. She doesn't want him to simply get away with it. If he did it, if he was sleeping with this woman and killed her in a rage and covered it up, she wants him to go to prison for the rest of his life. She will never forgive him. If he did it, she doesn't ever want to see him again.
Gallo said anybody could have used our cabin, Paul says, taken our hammer and killed her and cleaned it all up, and we would never even know.
But the cabin was locked, she says.
Someone could have broken in or found the hidden key.
He lowers his voice now to a whisper, and another look comes over his face, a pleading look.
We could say we'd had break-ins before, but since nothing was ever taken, we didn't bother to report it.
She whispers back,
that would be a lie. Just a small one, he says very quietly. I didn't do it, Olivia, and my life is on the line.
She looks back at him, her dread growing, and starts shaking her head.
No, we can't do that. Raleigh would know it was a lie.
He slumps in his chair and looks down at the table, suddenly defeated.
Yeah, you're right. Forget it.
Finally, he looks up, completely exhausted, and says bleakly,
how is Raleigh doing?
Not good. Not good at all.
He hasn't asked about her.
Robert Pierce is biding his time in his kitchen. When he picked his newspaper up off his front step that morning, there was already a crowd of reporters on the street in front of his house. They saw him and started to surge toward him, but he quickly stepped inside the house and slammed the door. He looked down at the front page of the Aylesford Record. As he read, a slow smile came over his face. They'd made an arrest, and it wasn't him. The news has put him in a very good mood. Maybe he will be able to relax now. Maybe he will be able to return to work. It's been wearing, the police always at his door, always looking at him as if it's just a matter of time until he screws up. But now they have arrested Paul Sharp. All attention will be on him. Robert can start living his life again, put all this behind him. He looks out the window and sees that the reporters are still out there. He knows they will wait all day until they get a statement from him. He's something of a celebrity. He goes up to his bedroom and dresses carefully. A nice pair of pants and a dress shirt. He combs his hair, admires himself in the mirror, and then he goes downstairs and opens the front door and steps out. The cameras flash repeatedly. He keeps his expression suitably serious. A bereaved husband, grateful at last that his wife's killer has been arrested. Chapter 32. An officer sticks his head in Webb's office door and says, "The Sharps and the Newells were all fingerprinted this morning, sir, and something very interesting has turned up."
Webb looks down at the report. What the hell was Paul Sharp's son doing in Amanda Pierce's house?
Olivia sits on her bed and looks at herself in the dresser mirror. She's ashen.
The detectives have called and want to see her again. They have asked her to bring Raleigh, too. Raleigh is in his room, having stayed home from school. Glenda is sticking by Olivia and Raleigh, showing people that she supports them. Olivia feels better having Glenda here. She remembers how people had stood and watched outside of Robert Pierce's house not that long ago, thinking that Robert Pierce had murdered his wife. And now there are people outside of her house, thinking that Paul is a killer. When she and Raleigh arrive back at the station, she is directed into an interview room, while Raleigh is asked to wait outside. Webb and Moen are there waiting for her. She's caught them in the middle of a conversation, which they abruptly break off. Mrs. Sharp, Webb says, thank you for coming in. Just so you know, this interview is purely voluntary. You are free to leave at any time. Detective Moen brings her water and looks at her as if in sympathy. Men can be such shits. Olivia's mouth is dry. She swallows. There's absolutely nothing she can tell them, one way or the other. She doesn't know anything. Nothing that happens in this interview will change anything. She must just get through it. Webb says, lab results confirm that the blood found in your cabin is Amanda Pierce's. Her head swims at the news, but she already expected it. Who else's blood could it be? He waits for her to say something. I don't know anything about it. You must have given it some thought, Webb chides her.
I think someone else must have killed her in our cabin.
Who do you think that might be?
I don't know.
She pauses and says, her husband, possibly?
What would her husband be doing in your cabin?
I don't know.
Olivia wants to cry, but refuses to. She can't explain it. She can't explain any of it. Why won't they just leave her alone? They know they've got him. Why torture her like this? She can't help them. Can't they see that she's suffering enough?
Is there anyone we don't know about who may have had access to the cabin? Webb asks.
No.
Did the Harrises ever visit?
No, never.
Did you ever tell them where it was, exactly?
No.
Anyone else?
No.
Okay, thank you. That's it for now. We'd like to speak to your son. You can stay, if you like.
They bring Raleigh in. He looks anxious and very young. He sits down beside her, and she tries to give him a reassuring look. She wants to put her arm around his shoulders and give him a squeeze, but she suspects he wouldn't like it.
Raleigh, I'm Detective Webb, and this is Detective Moen. We'd like to ask you some questions, if that's all right.
Raleigh looks at him uncomfortably.
Okay. You see, Raleigh, we found your fingerprints in the Pierce house. Can you explain that?
Olivia freezes at this second blow. Her son shoots her a look of alarm. No one says anything for a long moment. Finally, Raleigh asks,
do I need a lawyer?
I don't know. Do you? Webb says.
I want a lawyer,
Raleigh says, his voice breaking.
We'll get you one, Webb says, rising out of his chair. Stay put.
Raleigh has conferred privately with his lawyer, a young man named Dale Abbott, and his mother, and they have decided on a course of action. Raleigh is petrified. The interview resumes, Webb and Moen on one side of the table, Raleigh, his attorney, and his mother on the other side.
So, Raleigh, Webb says, are you going to tell us what your fingerprints are doing in the Pierce house?
Raleigh glances at his lawyer, who nods at him, and says,
I snuck into their house.
When was that?
It would have been early October. I don't know exactly.
Before Amanda Pierce's body was discovered?
Yes.
How did you get in?
Through a basement window. It wasn't locked.
And why did you do that?
Just for fun?
Raleigh's going to try not to admit to the hacking. It's all about damage control now.
I see.
Webb sits back in his chair, glances at the attorney.
That's breaking and entering, Raleigh.
He nods.
Did you take anything?
Raleigh shakes his head. No.
What were you doing there?
Just snooping.
Webb nods thoughtfully.
Snooping. Did you see anything interesting?
Raleigh glances at him.
Not really.
Did you see a cell phone anywhere?
Webb asks.
Raleigh nods.
Yeah, in a bottom drawer of the desk, one of those pay-as-you-go kind. You must have found it when you searched the house. No, we didn't. I didn't take it, I swear.
Did you look inside the phone, Raleigh?
No, I wasn't that interested.
It's okay if you looked inside the phone, Raleigh.
I didn't.
Okay.
Webb sits back again as if disappointed. Then he says, Did you kill Amanda Pierce?
Raleigh recoils in shock.
No, I just went in their house, looked around, and left.
Webb stares back at him. Finally, he says, I'm afraid we'll have to charge you with breaking and entering.
Raleigh sits back in his chair. It's a relief, really. He can't believe how much of a relief it is. It feels so good that he suddenly blurts out, I broke into another house too, 32 Finch Street. He doesn't want to have to worry about Carmen anymore. He'll admit to those two. They can't prove he was in the last house he hit. The police must know about that one already, but he was wearing gloves. He's not going to admit to any more than he has to.
Glenda makes something comforting for supper, mac and cheese, but the three of them simply pick at their food. Glenda watches Olivia and Raleigh with concern. She has no appetite either. They're both sitting quietly at their places, faces drawn, each lost in their own private hell. Neither of them has said anything about what happened down at the police station, and although Glenda's dying to know, she doesn't want to ask. Raleigh says, Mom, maybe you should go lie down.
Good idea, Glenda agrees. Olivia looks like she's about to collapse.
Why don't you go lie down in the living room? I'll clean up.
She tucks a blanket around Olivia on the sofa and glances out the window to the street. Everyone has gone away. She imagines they will be back tomorrow. Murder is always big news. Why did Robert and Amanda Pierce ever have to move here? She thinks bitterly. Olivia falls asleep on the sofa. Finally, around 9 o'clock, Glenda decides to go. She can't stay at the Sharps forever. Adam needs her at home. She leaves a note that she'll be back in the morning and walks home in the dark, her footsteps echoing hollowly on the pavement. When she arrives at home, Adam tells her that they're out of milk and bread.
Fine, she says, not even taking off her coat. Why don't you come with me to the store, then?
He puts on his jacket and heads out with her.
How are they doing?
Adam asks, obviously worried.
They're going to be okay.
Everything's going to be all right, Glenda says. She doesn't know what else to say. They walk the rest of the way in silence. The bell on the door chimes as they enter the convenience store. Glenda is completely drained and just wants to pick up her things and go home. As she turns away from the refrigerator with her milk, Adam trailing behind her, she spots Carmen in the aisle in front of her. Shit. She definitely doesn't want to talk to her. She's a busybody, and Glenda is in no mood for it. She resents the way she's been sticking her nose in everywhere about the break-ins, hounding Olivia. She wishes she'd leave Raleigh alone, and she certainly doesn't want to talk about Paul being arrested. Carmen will be all over that. Glenda considers putting the milk down quietly on the floor and making a quick exit. Too late. At that moment, Carmen turns her head and sees them. A smile of recognition lights her face. Shit.
Glenda, isn't it?
Carmen asks, approaching her.
Yes, Glenda says, making her way briskly to the front of the store where the bread is, avoiding her eye.
But Carmen follows her. She's really not great at reading social cues, Glenda thinks.
Hi, Adam,
Carmen adds. Glenda notices that her son is trying to avoid Carmen, too.
You know, you remind me of my own son a bit,
Carmen says to Adam.
Same dark hair and eyes.
Adam looks as if he wishes he could disappear, and Glenda wants to tell Carmen to get lost.
My Luke was a bit of a handful. He used to get up to all kinds of trouble. Drinking, taking my car without permission.
Glenda stares at her, but Carmen focuses her eyes on Adam and says,
Did you tell your mom that I saw you the other night?
Glenda says, What are you talking about?
Oh, nothing. Never mind,
Carmen says, as if finally getting the hint.
Have a good night.
And she wanders off to another aisle. Glenda makes her purchases, eager to get away from Carmen. Late at night, Olivia pads down the carpeted hall to look in on Raleigh. She silently pushes open the door.
She stands there for a moment in the dark, studying the bed. Then, alarmed, she flicks the light switch on. Her son isn't there. Her heart speeds up and she turns away from his bedroom and creeps downstairs. The kitchen, living room, and den are dark. He's not there either, sitting alone, brooding in the dark. She turns on the lights to be sure. She returns to the kitchen and opens the door to the adjoining garage. Raleigh's bike is where it should be, his helmet hanging from the handlebar. She returns upstairs and quietly makes her way to the only room she hasn't checked, the office at the end of the hall. The room is completely dark, except for the slight glow coming from the computer. It's her husband's computer, and Raleigh is engrossed in its contents. "Raleigh, what are you doing?" she says. Chapter 33. Webb arrives very early at the station the next morning after a poor night's sleep. He grabs a coffee and heads to his office, then he sits back in his chair, gazing at the wall opposite, his mind busy. They can't hold Paul Sharp in custody much longer before the prosecutor has to charge him or let him go. It's Amanda Pierce's blood in his cabin. His hammer is missing. Sharp was seen arguing with the victim shortly before she disappeared. But his story that he was warning her away from Larry Harris has a certain plausibility. They know Larry was seeing her. Olivia Sharp said that Larry Harris had never been to the cabin. Is it possible she was wrong? Could Harris have arranged to meet Amanda at the Sharps' cabin that weekend while he was at the conference? Maybe he killed her. He parked in the outside lot at the resort and had his story ready that he was working and fell asleep. No one seemed to care that he missed most of the reception until he became involved in a murder investigation. The only thing that went wrong is that they found Amanda's car with her body in the trunk. She'd made that convenient fib to her husband so it would look like Amanda had arranged her own disappearance. Paul Sharp was the only one who knew about the affair, and he wouldn't say anything, especially if he hadn't known they'd been at his cabin. Possibly. But Paul Sharp might have said something. When she disappeared, staff at the hotel might have come forward about seeing them together, and then Harris would have been under a microscope. But still, with no hard evidence, and especially no body, it would look as if an unhappy, unfaithful wife had run from her life. Or maybe Robert Pierce is the killer. Pierce has been lying to them. According to Harris, Pierce had access to Amanda's burner phone and knew about their affair. And Raleigh Sharp saw the burner phone in Pierce's desk after Amanda had disappeared. But it wasn't there when they searched the house. Pierce must have gotten rid of it. Maybe he'd been watching her. He seemed the type. Maybe he knew where she was going that night, drove up to the cabin, saw her with her lover, Larry Harris, Paul Sharp, waited for her to be alone and bashed her head in. Pierce doesn't have an alibi either. He'll talk to the prosecutor. They'll let Paul Sharp go for now and see how everybody reacts. Webb has time. Time to get under everybody's skin. There's no statute of limitations on murder. Olivia is startled by the kitchen phone ringing early Wednesday morning. It's Detective Webb telling her that they are releasing her husband without charge. She hangs up and stands perfectly still. Her drive to the police station passes in a blur. She feels numb. Olivia sits in the waiting area at the station, watching for Paul to appear. Torn between relief and dread, she wants to put the moment off. But it's come. She hears footsteps and stands up. Then she sees Paul. She walks up and hugs him, like she's done 1,000 times before, but this time is different. She's not sure about him. She can feel both their hearts beating. After a moment, she pulls away. He looks at her warily. "Let's get you home," she says, and turns away so he can't see the doubt in her eyes. She's already texted Glenda with the news, telling her not to come by. Raleigh waits anxiously for his mom to return home with his dad. She'd told him she was going to pick him up. Raleigh's not going to school again today. His father is innocent, he tells himself. They're letting him go. But Raleigh's relief is tinged with uneasiness. He can tell that his mother has her doubts. Raleigh has doubts, too. He's not sure of anything anymore. He hadn't found anything illuminating on his dad's computer, but Raleigh also knows something that they don't. And he's going to have to tell them.
When his parents arrive home, it's awkward. His mom smiles at him as if everything is fine, but he can tell from her drawn face that things are far from fine. His father looks awful and smells like he could use a shower. Raleigh can feel the tension emanating from both of his parents. They all end up in the kitchen, and his mom says, "I've told your father that you're being charged." "It'll be okay, son," his dad says, pulling him into a hug. Raleigh nods, swallows. But it's not himself that he's worried about right now. It's his dad. Raleigh has to confess to his parents, and he's dreading it. Raleigh must tell them the truth. Beginning is difficult. "There's something I have to tell you," Raleigh says. He can see at once from the closed look that comes over his mother's troubled face that she doesn't want to hear it. She's got enough to deal with. He hates to hurt her more than he already has, but he must say this. He can't seem to get the words out. "What is it, Raleigh?" his father says tiredly. He's been humbled, obviously, by his own recent history. He's not on his high horse now, Raleigh thinks. "I lied to you," he says. "I lied to both of you about the break-ins." His mother looks more anxious than ever. His father looks deeply weary. "I told you and the lawyer that I only broke into two houses, but it was more." He watches his dad's brow darken. "It was more like 9 or 10, he confesses. His dad looks at him sharply. His mother looks horrified. "There's something else I need to tell you," Raleigh says uncomfortably. "I didn't want you to know, but I broke into the Newells." "What? When?" his father asks. Raleigh swallows. "It was the night they were over here having dinner. I knew that Adam would be out that night, too." His mom gasps. "You broke into our dearest friend's house while they were over here having dinner with us?" She looks utterly betrayed. "How could you? Why?" Raleigh feels himself coloring. He gives a helpless shrug. "I was hacking. I was serious about it. It's a skill, and it takes practice. So I snuck into people's houses when they weren't home and hacked into their computers." He risks another glance at his parents. They're staring at him in disbelief. "I was getting really good," he says, "but I'm not doing it anymore." They're still staring at him, appalled. There's a pregnant silence. "I knew you wouldn't approve, but I never did any harm. It's not like I ever stole any data or shared it or put anything on anyone's computers or told anybody what I found," Raleigh protests. "I never tried to blackmail anybody or anything," he offers in his own defense. "Blackmail," his mother repeats, her hand at her throat. "Mom, relax. I never did anything like that. It was more just getting experience." "Experience, is that what you call it?" his dad says. Raleigh doesn't like his tone. It's the old dad tone, and it pisses him off. "Yeah, well, maybe you should listen to me for a change," Raleigh says sharply. "What are you talking about?" his mom asks. "I know things about your dearest friends," Raleigh says. Olivia feels her heart freeze. She stares at her son, not so sure she wants to hear what he has to say. She feels dizzy, shocked. What secrets could Glenda and Keith have? She glances at her husband, but he's watching Raleigh intently, as if he struck a nerve.
"What are you getting at, Raleigh?" Paul says.
"I saw things on their computer," Raleigh says.
"We gathered that," Paul says in a tight voice. "What did you see?"
"Keith is a prick," Raleigh says with energy. "Don't talk that way," Olivia says sharply. "Why not? It's true. You should see what was on his computer. I saw his emails. He's been cheating on Glenda, seeing someone else behind her back. I couldn't tell you because they're your friends." Olivia feels sickened. She can't speak.
"When was this?" Paul asks.
"I told you it was that night they were here for dinner, the night before Mom saw the texts on my phone and found out what I was doing," Raleigh says miserably. Olivia tries to focus. Keith is cheating on Glenda, and Glenda has no idea. Olivia is certain that Glenda doesn't know. Now what does she do? Does she tell her or leave her in ignorance? Olivia glances at her husband and remembers when Becky came over to tell her her suspicions about Paul. She realizes, her heart sinking, that she's going to have to tell Glenda.
"Are you sure about this?" Paul asks.
Of course I'm sure. I saw it with my own eyes. There was no way to misinterpret what he wrote. I even sent some emails back to his girlfriend from his account, and they weren't very nice.
Olivia watches her son, feels her jaw drop open. Raleigh says,
"So at least now he probably knows that somebody was in his computer and knows what he's doing."
He snorts. "I hope he's been losing sleep over it. Maybe he thinks it was Adam. Why do you think Adam drinks so much?
He drinks to forget that his dad is such an asshole."
"Raleigh," Paul begins, looking unnerved,
"you can't just mess with people's lives like that."
"He's an asshole. Serves him right." Olivia wonders if Glenda ever told Keith that Raleigh was breaking into houses, even though she promised she wouldn't. Olivia sometimes lets things slip to Paul that she said she wouldn't share.
"The emails were hidden," Raleigh continues. "You wouldn't know they were there unless you were looking, like I was."
"How did you find them?" Paul asks.
"It's easy if you know what you're doing. I can get into a powered-off computer in about 3 minutes. I just use a USB flash drive to boot up the computer. Most computers allow you to boot from a live USB, and that way you can get around the internal security. Then, with a few commands, I can create a back door, and I'm in. Once I was in Keith's computer, I could tell he was trying to hide something because he was deleting his browser history. But he didn't delete the cookies, so I was able to get the username and password for his hidden email account. And then I could get into his account and see his emails and pretend to be him and send whatever I wanted."
Olivia doesn't know whether to be horrified or impressed. "Do you know who the woman was?" she asks.
"No, it was some silly name on the email account, something made up."
"Jesus, Raleigh, you shouldn't have done that," Paul says.
Raleigh looks at his father as if challenging him somehow and says, "Do you think he could have been seeing the woman who was murdered?"
Olivia watches the two of them, stunned into speechlessness.
"No, of course not," Paul says. "That's ridiculous."
"He knows our cabin," Raleigh says.
"Are you suggesting that Keith murdered her?" Paul says, clearly horrified at the idea.
"Keith can't possibly be involved with this.
He can't be a murderer. He's my best friend."
Chapter 34 Becky jumps when the door opens and her husband walks in. He'd been too upset to go into the office this morning, and then the detectives had called him to come down to answer more questions. She can see that he is shaken, but he's home from the police station. He hasn't been arrested.
"What happened?" she asks.
"They asked me if I'd ever been to the Sharps' cabin." Larry sinks, clearly exhausted, onto the sofa in the living room.
"They're still acting like they think I killed her." "Why do they think that, Becky? I had an affair with her, but I swear I didn't kill her."
He looks up at her, worried. She sits down beside him. Then,
"It's just us now, Larry. You've never been to that cabin, have you?"
"No, absolutely not. I swear, I don't know where it is." But he's lied to her before. He could have known about the Sharps' cabin somehow. It's been on the news this morning, online, that Paul Sharp has been released without charge. She can't be the only one who finds that odd, but they obviously don't think he did it. They must think someone else killed her in his cabin, and they must think it was either Robert Pierce or her husband, Larry. Back to square one. Which of them did it? She doesn't know.
Robert Pierce can't believe it. Yesterday, he was in the clear, gave a press conference, and celebrated, alone, with a few beers. Today he learns that Paul Sharp has been released without charge. He reads about it in the news, and then those damn detectives show up on his doorstep around lunchtime.
"Mr. Pierce," Webb said, "we'd like to have another little chat with you."
"About what?" Robert said suspiciously.
"About your wife?"
"I thought you caught the guy," Robert said.
"Quick work, by the way. What do you want with me?"
"Well, you see, we had to release him. Not enough evidence."
"You're kidding, right?" Robert said, his heart pounding harder. "My wife's blood on the floor of his cabin isn't enough for you?"
"Oddly enough, no," Webb replied. "We'd like you to come down to the station."
"Now?"
"Yes." And so, here he is, back in this claustrophobic room, but this time he has been read his rights, and the interview is being taped.
The detectives have let Sharp go. They will be after him now, the husband. They always think it's the husband.
We think you knew your wife was seeing someone else, Webb begins. Robert says nothing. We know she had a burner phone. We haven't been able to find it, but we know she had one.
Robert remains warily silent.
Do you know where it is? Webb presses.
Still, he says nothing.
We know she had one, Webb continues, because Larry Harris told us.
Robert isn't going to rise to the bait. Webb gets right in his face and says,
We know you had her burner phone because Harris told us that you called him from it on the morning of Friday, September 29th, the day your wife disappeared.
Robert shrugs.
That's not true. You've only got his word for it. He was screwing her. He'd say anything.
We don't just have his word for it. We have a witness.
What are you talking about? A local boy broke into your house and found the burner phone in your desk drawer after Amanda went missing. But it wasn't there when we searched the house a few days later. What did you do with the phone, Robert?
He doesn't answer. His heart is racing. Instead, he says,
What boy?
But the detective ignores his question.
We know you lied to us. We know you knew she was seeing Larry. Was she seeing Paul Sharp, too? Did you know about that? How many numbers were in that phone? Was she sleeping with both of them? That must have been hard to take. We know you had the phone, so you must have known she was planning to meet someone that weekend at that cabin. Which one was it? And you went there and saw them together, and once she was alone, you bashed her head in.
Robert says nothing, but his heart is pounding.
Maybe the burner phone is at the bottom of a lake somewhere, like the hammer, Webb says.
I want to call my attorney, Robert says.
Olivia, Paul says to her in a troubled voice when they're going to bed that night. What if Keith was seeing Amanda?
She'd been thinking the same thing herself all day and all evening. Part of her dismissed the idea as improbable. Surely Keith didn't really know her. He'd met her at the neighborhood party like everyone else, but he didn't work in the same company as Paul and Larry, where she was a regular temp. The chance he was seeing Amanda seems like a stretch. Glenda had never